Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
From Postcard from the Past and Wardour Studios, this is Podcast from the Past, the Postcard Podcast. This is a place where the sky is as blue as a forget-me-not and the sea as flat as the postcard it sits on. As we consider picture postcards and explore what it was that caused us to keep hold of these small, ephemeral rectangles. Each time I welcome two guests, and it's their postcards that act as small clues to direct us towards memories, mysteries and stories. I'm Tom Jackson, and I'm delighted to say that my guests today are food writer Tim Haywood and academic Annabella Pollen. Annabella and Tim, welcome to Podcast from the Past.
Thank you.
Now, Dr. Annabella Pollen of the University of Brighton works across a range of areas, including mass photography, popular image culture, and the histories of art, craft, design, and dress, especially stuff that goes on at the margins, the alternative, the non-canonical. Her particular interests include the woodcraft folk, Victorian Valentines, Edwardian picture postcards, and the history of the silhouette portrait. Plus, her next book will explore social nudism in the 20th century. Think about that one. Now, Annabella joins us today with a TQ9 postmark. What's that?
TQ9 is Totnes in South Devon. It's not where I was born and it's not where I live, but it's a sort of spiritual home.
Right, why is that?
Well, it's a strange magnet place for witches and weirdos and hippies and others.
I see where we're going now.
Yes, quite. When I was in my early 20s, late teens, I moved there from Plymouth, where I was born, which is about 25 miles away. And I moved to this strange small town and, you know, hung out with the hippies and grew my hair and wove it into dreadlocks and lived in a caravan and chanted in the woods and did all those exciting kind of mystical finding yourself type things, but in a very local South Devon place.
This was your South Devon, California?
It was indeed.
Very good. And it stays with you? This is still part of you?
Yeah, it was the place where I met most of my long-standing and enduring friends. So it was the years that I was there were the years where conventionally people might go to university, but I didn't go to university in those years. So I formed my sort of first adult friends there, my independent adult friends, and they've stayed with me. So it's somewhere I return to and I'm very fond of. It's a very weird and odd place. That's the postcode that I can't wash off me.
And TQ, is that Torquay?
Yeah, so it's not big enough or important enough to have its own postcode, but it is at the centre of the meeting of the ley lines for the hippies who believe in that sort of thing.
Wow, fantastic. Now, here's a key question. Do you still send postcards?
Yes, I sent some yesterday, actually.
Very good. Tell me more.
I decided that the best way to get in touch with various people who I'm already in touch with via WhatsApp or Facebook or other forms to kind of rekindle some get-togethers over the summer. I'm just about to go on my annual leave, and lots of people I haven't seen since the beginning of the lockdown, you know, the first of the lockdowns, I thought I'd reconnect with them via some postcards. So I had great pleasure delving through some of my old postcards, of which I have many thousands, and selecting the right ones for the right people.
Now, you will know Tim Hayward from his food writing in the FT. You'll have heard him presenting on the food programme or panelling on the Kitchen Cabinet on Radio 4. You may well have read his books, Food DIY, The DIY Cook, Knife, and most recently, A Hymn to Bread in All Its Incarnations, From Sourdough to the Chorleywood Process, and Everything You Can Do with Bread, the superbly titled Loaf Story. Now, and appropriately enough, Tim owns a bakery and restaurant in Cambridge, Fitzbillies. And Tim, you come to us today with a postmark with just numbers on it, I think, 94109. What's that?
That's a California zip code.
Wow.
I lived for a while in San Francisco, and it was in the last few years before Silicon Valley really took off.
Right. This is a while ago.
It's a really long time ago. I'm really old. I lived in a 1930s tower block on top of the Stockton Tunnel, which was a great place to be in the Loma Prieta earthquake. it was a great place. I just graduated. I did photography as an art student, where I basically got really interested in postcards. Became obsessed with John Hind.
You tried to replicate his style.
Absolutely, I tried to replicate his process with a sort of three colour split in a camera. We were building cameras. It was great stuff. But after that, I like everybody else, tried to make a living doing it and failed. Started working in restaurants. Fell in love with a waitress who happened to be an American, and then followed her back to the States. And we ended up in San Francisco, which was wonderful. I mean, and I think just a really sort of formative part of my life.
And where did you study?
I was at Bournemouth and Poole College of Art and Design.
Ah, yeah, well, highly regarded, I think.
it was pretty good then. Although, weirdly, I spent a lot of time at Brighton, where the Mass Observation Archive was, because I was also fascinated with their photography collections. That's the kind of early British street stuff, yeah.
Ah, interesting. So it must have been quite a jump to go from Bournemouth to San Francisco.
Oh, God, yes. It was madly, madly exciting. It was back in the time also when I think everybody thought if you were English, you were fabulously exotic.
Tim, you are fabulously exotic.
How very lovely of you to say so.
But I'm intrigued by this idea that you were trying to replicate the processes that John Hind used. I mean, listeners will be familiar with the John Hind sort of highly saturated colour postcards. Because what people may not be aware of is that he was very much a pioneer in aura, perhaps not a pioneer, but a hero in this kind of colour processing. He was an early adopter of British photographic colour processing.
He was phenomenal in that respect. I was of the last generation who were using sort of a lot of film, and we were being trained. You know, we spend months in studios lighting sort of cars and food and things in a way that they were absolutely perfect, and all we really wanted was to try and get some kind of spirit back into what we were doing, some kind of mess or gunge. people were experimenting with everything from sort of boiling the photographic paper right the way through to sort of, I don't know, pouring domestic bleach into the developer. I mean, all kinds of weird things. And I just got really obsessed with him because I think the first postcard I saw, I think, was one of his Irish ones.
Yes.
And I couldn't believe he had all those red-haired children in a line, and it looked really weird. And then I think before I'd even read the sort of books on him, I'd noticed the thing he does with the small bunch of flowers in the corner.
Yes,
which is a bit of dangle or sort of bottom left, a bunch of azaleas or something. And if you look back at that now, his delight in colour is so clear that he'd be looking at, you know, whatever it was he was supposed to be photographing, the bay at Babbicombe or something, and no, that's not colourful enough. Yes. Damn it, let's stick in a bunch of red flowers.
Yes.
I love that. I love that delight. And at one point, I actually sort of built the rig with three black and white cameras, shooting through sort of two-way glass and with different coloured filters over it, producing three negatives at once. I was using it to try and shoot portraits, which was insanely stupid. But that was the process they were doing in Hollywood at the same time as John Hind was doing it.
Was this what we used to call the Technicolor three-strip process?
That was what they called Technicolor, yeah. And Hind was kind of inventing it himself, yeah.
Amazing. But I was disappointed to discover not that long ago that some of those red jumpers that pop out in the foreground were in fact painted on in post-production.
Which is much, much easier to do when you've got three black and white negatives.
Right, but, yes, I see what you mean.
Yes.
Because you can isolate them.
Yeah, exactly. Have you ever seen the bright red Life photographer's jacket?
No.
It's a very, very weird bit of sort of photographic history. I had one when I was a student and foolishly gave it to a girlfriend and never got it back. But Life magazine used to issue like a red combat jacket with the word Life across the back in big white letters. And what you would do is stick it on the assistant, and the assistant would stand in a shot, so it would be logoed, but also you'd be using them as sort of colour reference and size reference. It was a lovely... So, you know, here I am in South America, in the jungle, photographing this incredible waterfall. You know, Brad, put the jacket on, go stand in there, and everybody will understand what it is, and it'll be branded. It was a lovely idea.
Scale reference as well.
Scale reference as well. But I think John Hind's flowers are like the life jacket.
Yeah. Well, there aren't that many postcard photographers. I mean, Bella will have to say something to say about this, I'm sure. But there aren't that many who have a distinctive style. And certainly Hind and his team did manage to create an aesthetic that was not totally unique, but very easily recognisable.
Completely. But also, I love the way it's kind of mixed into our cultural recollection. My family, my dear old mum, still lives down in Christchurch near Bournemouth. And I go down and visit her sometimes. And weirdly, the English sort of seaside has become more fashionable with the younger generation. So I walk along the seafront now and all of the beach huts have been repainted in these kind of Farrow and Ball colours. And you realise that Farrow and Ball took the colour of the beach huts from a John Hind photograph of the beach huts. And now people are paying a bloody fortune for the things and painting them the colours of a John Hind photograph. Because that's what the British seaside is. Slightly cooked. Slightly, you know, turn up the saturation in Instagram. I love it. I love it.
You turn up the saturation optimistically. I think that's what it is. If you have sunshine, you don't need to do that.
No, precisely that.
Well, Tim, when did you last send a postcard?
When did I last send a postcard?
There's no wrong answer to this.
No, it's a weird thing. I think the last time I sent a postcard, I sent about 5,000 of them.
Right. Promotional?
Promotional.
Or just very friendly?
No, I was running a little sort of independent magazine, and because it was so much about print and going out to people who loved print and loved the object, then it seemed like the most obvious way to actually send something out. I don't do it now because I'm immensely committed to new media.
Right.
I really do think that Instagram is taking up that place in people's lives of being able to make images and attach messages to them and get them out there. It's different, but it's as strangely valid and new and interesting.
That's a long-winded excuse for not sending a postcard. fair enough. Look, before we hear about the cards that Tim and Bella have brought along, quick one of mine. This is, of course, a sort of postcard from the past card like I do on Twitter and in my book. This is an old card from which I've selected just a part of the message. So this first one, it's a black and white multi-view. Not sure who's published the card. It's a picture of four views from Belfast with a very, very blobby cat in the middle on a horseshoe. And it's good luck from Belfast. The images of the Parliament buildings, the Shores Bridge, Donegal Quay and Cave Hill, and Donegal Square. And the luck, obviously it's a bit of a thing with postcards that they say good luck on the front and some of the message is already built into the card that way. You know, it's a missive of luck. But I was intrigued by the message on this one. This is from August 1961, even before your time, Tim. And it's sent to Hampshire, Southampton, Hampshire, from Belfast. And the message just intrigued me because, as I say, it sort of feels about luck and good wishes and the emotions that you put onto these cards. It says, I'm at home at present, but am due back on the 15th for the second retreat. I think probably a religious retreat, I'm not sure. First one went not too bad. Thank you for your help. Please continue to pray. I have a very special intention. Dash. A friend is involved in a lawsuit for several thousand pounds, and the case comes up on Monday next. Hope you have had a good rest and that your health is keeping better. Health is keeping better. God bless you. And then some abbreviation, some initials for the name. So I was just intrigued by the fact that not only did this person want prayers for health and happiness, there's a very specific request. They've got a friend who's going to court for several thousand pounds and they want goodwill to make that successful. So there you go.
You sure they don't want a modest investment? This sounds like one of those fantastic Nigerian bank scams, doesn't it?
Yes, there's certainly the preamble to it. they forgot to do the hit at the end. Well, I should remind those of you who are listening that images of these cards, including the blobby cat, are all on the blog, postcardfromthepast.co.uk. You can see that we're not making it up. Now, you've both been kind enough to dig out for this podcast some postcards of your own. Bella, let's start with you. What's the first card you've got for us? This is something quite old, I think.
Yes, actually, I don't know the date of it. I imagine it is from what people call the golden age of postcards.
The golden age.
Yes, indeed. I know from a bit of nerdy historical knowledge that the divided back of postcards came in 1904. So it's after 1904, but I'm assuming before the First World War. And it's a black and white image on the front of Madeira Road in Brighton, which is now a very busy thoroughfare. It's the place where if there's kind of, you know, vintage car runs down to Brighton from London, that's where all the cars will assemble. It's now a really busy location with volleyball courts and all sorts of activities going on, shops and clubs and so on. But in this postcard, so maybe 1905, it's got a couple of horse-drawn carriages. It's got the visible rails of the Volks Railway, the old Victorian sort of leisure railway that runs along the seafront. And it's got the terrace and the arches that are part of that famous part of the sort of east side of Brighton seafront. The postcard itself is not particularly interesting for its image, though. It's all about what's on the back.
Well, I'll stick with the image for a minute, though, just because I think it's interesting.
Sure.
It's this sort of parade, it says here, Soper's Bazaar. These are sort of iron orientalist arches, aren't they? Going on for half a mile or so, I think.
Yeah, they're currently under threat, actually, and mostly they're covered over because this is a kind of bit of local controversy. They're going to cost so much money to repair. They've fallen into such a state of terrible disrepair that the council locally doesn't have enough money to repair them. So this is actually rather a sort of mournful image of when they were at their peak and at their most beautiful. It's a huge amount of painted, decorative, wrought iron that goes on for a really long way, pretty much from the Palace Pier out to the beginnings of what's now the Marina and Black Rock. So, yeah, they're a sort of beautiful and iconic part of Brighton, and here they're probably seen at their best.
And what were they then at the beginning of the 20th century? What happened in those arches, under those arches?
Well, interestingly, there's not really anything under them.
Right.
There is now that, you know, some of them have are turned into shops, and they're, in fact, some of them are really interesting little art galleries and so on. But the main part was just a covered walkway.
Right.
Which seems incredibly luxurious, I think, to just have that covered walkway, but perhaps rather practical in the high winds and the bad weather of the British seaside. So it was just somewhere to kind of promenade that wasn't as exposed as walking on the top.
But it's a nice bit of Brighton, that, actually, you know, in all kinds of ways, just because Brighton itself is such a busy town, And the Palace Pier is such a kind of jangling, noisy place, which is wonderful. But as you kind of as you stroll away, or if you've got the you catch the moment, jump on the little Volks railway, which seems to be running these days, it gets quieter and quieter.
Yeah, you can have a moment where you can sort of feel a moment of escape if you look in the right direction at the right time of day. But yeah, Brighton's not about getting away from it all. It's about throwing yourself into the thick of things, I think. So you'll have those moments quite briefly, I think, on Madeira Drive in the 21st century.
Well, let's flip the card over, though. In fact, the message is a vestige of the pre-divided back days. The message starts on the front, I think.
It does. And on the front, it is written in rather beautiful handwriting, which is kind of typical of these Edwardian cards. Often
and legible, thank God.
Yes, yes. They're often misspelled, but they're beautifully lettered. So it says, were any of your relations staying at, and then pregnant pause while you turn the card over, Albion House, Brighton? No question mark. But then the key part and the main body of the message is the next part of the writing. And it says, I have got some news for you. But as I don't want anybody else to read it, I will try and put it under the stamp. Yours truly, Burton. And then the stamp, the area of the stamp is gone. But frustratingly, so is part of the message. And this is the thing that's always intrigued me about this particular postcard. It's not actually one that I own. It's one from Brighton Museum's collection. Oh, okay. But I had a wonderful job a while ago, well, quite some time ago now, maybe 15 years ago, where I had the delightful task of looking through Brighton Museum's collections, what they call their reserve collections, so the stuff that's not on display, in search of anything that was to do with love, courtship, romance, sex.
Oh, how lovely.
Basically had this amazing job where I could look through those collections with a one-track mind. So I put on these kind of heart-shaped spectacles and went through all sorts of their collections. And what I wanted from the postcard was, I thought, oh, there'll be saucy postcards from people going to Brighton for a dirty weekend.
Yes.
That will be a great place to go and look for evidence of love and sex. Most of them had nothing but pictures of places because they'd been collected by the local studies centre.
Right,
so they were
rather
dull sort of topographical cards until you turned them over.
Yes.
And then there was plenty of evidence of people using Brighton as a place for flirtation and romance and getaway and so on. But because I had that one-track mind and because I was looking for love and sex everywhere, I found it in all the concealed
Here she
messages.
Comes again, they said, as you entered the museum. Oh,
yes.
For God's sake. Give that woman a glass of water.
Cold shower, please. So, yes, I went looking for suggestive messages and often I saw them when there weren't any. So my expectation was that this message under the stamp was something so hot and rude that it had to be, you know, sealed up. And
sounds like it.
And sort of closed away. You can actually see two of the words from whatever this tiny
under the stamp
message. Yeah. So
what can you see? I can't see anything on my copy, but
well, you have to go right in there. You see, this is what you have to do if you're a dedicated
researcher. I've got it blown up on my screen now. It's amazing.
It says, "Get off." Those are
oh
two words
God.
That may be separated by some other words.
Yes, yes.
I don't know whether the person who took this stamp off steamed it off so they were able to get to the message, or whether they scraped it off and lost half of the message
made
on
a
the,
bloody mess of it,
the paper. Whatever, yeah. Or was it a curator or an archivist later going in?
So not only do you not know the date of the card because of that, you've missed the whole nub of the message. The mystery
remains.
Yeah, but
remains. I think it makes it all the more exciting to not know.
Definitely.
So many cards were used for really functional purposes. And I like that banal element of the everyday communication. People saying, please, can you return my scissors? Or I'll meet you at the clock tower at 7 p.m. But the idea that there's something really kind of dangerous and important that must be concealed makes me think about how the postcard in its, you know, early days was this thing that was seen to be rather rude and rather risky.
Yes.
It was sending messages for all to see. You know, the postman might be able to read it, your landlord.
It's possibly flagrant. I love it.
Yeah,
it's,
absolutely.
It's such a bad strategy to try and counter that by putting the message under a half an inch square that is going to get ruined by the gum on the stamp anyway. It's just a bad plan. They should have thought this through.
Oh, but it's so lovely. Doesn't your heart go out to people trying to do that stuff? That combination of gentility and fear. And I don't know. It's just something beautiful about it, really.
Yeah. No, it gives it an extra resonance for sure, doesn't it?
The
mystery of the who's on the front, where are they heading? And, of course, the line of the railway and the terrace gives you such a kind of almost a surreal move towards the horizon with sort of exaggerated perspective, going nowhere, and then the message that's disappeared. It's the whole thing is a kind of visual poem, I think.
Absolutely.
You can't do that on Instagram, for sure.
Yeah, well, those kind of secret messages were often really poor strategies, but that's the delight of them. And certainly as a historian, they're the ones that you pore over longer to try and crack the code. So they didn't conceal. They were revelatory in their own way.
Yeah, well, I hope MS Pound in Highbury New Park, N, North London, I suppose, was pleased to receive that. And they could understand. Hopefully they did get the message. They understood. And they may have sent a return postcard saying, "What the hell were you talking about?"
Yeah. Get off what? The bus, the tram?
You know we've had a phone fitted. You could call us. Very good, very good. Oh, well, thank you for that one. Now, Tim, what's the first card that's fallen on your doormat?
Oh, this is an absolute belter. This is a this is a card from a restaurant in Paris called the Tour d'Argent. And if you're a modern foodie, you probably wouldn't go there because it's a terrible tourist trap now. But basically, it's a picture of a bloke carving a duck. And to one side, there's a sort of torture device, which is a duck press. I first read about this place when I was a kid. I suppose I must have been a young teen. And I wasn't sort of interested in food at the time, but I suppose it was probably in Julia Child or somewhere like that. Something I'd picked up and I was just leafing through. It was this story about a restaurant in Paris where they would effectively take a Challans duck, which is a particularly good breed of duck, which has been killed by smothering rather than the usual way of bleeding it out. So it's still got a little bit of its blood in it. And then the duck would be partially roasted and then the breast would be cut off. Very, very rare, and the rest of the duck cocks were put to a silver duck press, and the top is screwed down, and all of the juice comes out, and it's used to make a reduced sauce.
This looks like a little sort of cider press or something, but it's very
exactly
delicate and expensive looking.
You can actually do it with a cider press, although it's actually not delicate at all. These things weigh, you know, half hundredweight, and wow. they're astonishing bits of kit. And it takes a big, strong waiter to turn the top, and there's this crunching noise, and the juice comes out. And anyway, I thought to myself, you know, one day I'm going to go to this place, and I never got the chance. And then I started writing about food. And I was writing for The Guardian and making some videos for them. And they said, "Is there anything you particularly like to do?" And I said, "Yeah, I'd really like to go to Paris, the Tour d'Argent." They said, "Okay, yeah, no problem.
And you'd never been at that stage?
I'd never been, no. That when we had budget. So they sent me over with a wonderful director, camera woman, a Canadian girl who was just absolutely... And we got out there, and it turned out to be the one day of the week they were closed because I'd failed to do my research. So I did the whole sort of, this is, you know, by phone in the morning, and I speak very, very little French at all. This whole sort of, you know, do you know who I am? Do you know who I am?
Oh.
And they did.
And when things are closed in Paris, they're closed.
Yeah, well, they opened the place up for me.
You're this joking.
No kidding. It was amazing. They called up one of the waiters who did it, and the proprietor was there, and they said, "You know, if your video is a video for an English newspaper, you know, we're interested." They did it with me there alone in the room, and it got dark outside, and the hotel, the restaurant is at the top of an apartment building. It looks out over Notre Dame.
Wonderful.
And I'm sitting there waiting for this duck to be crushed at my table side, and the lights have gone down outside. The lights come on at Notre Dame, looking down onto it. And it's the single most gloriously, beautifully romantic moment I've ever experienced. And I'm by myself, apart from this, you know, extremely beautiful director. She's married, I'm married. There's damn all you can do about it. And I just, I don't know. It was such a strange, overpoweringly weird feeling. Anyway, sorry, it all goes very strange. As it happens, later on, I tried to replicate it at home and I couldn't build a device like it. So I ended up doing it by putting the duck in a tin tray and driving my car over it. which had a similar effect. Anyway, the reason
behind
all this...
You can't do that in the restaurant.
You can't do that in the restaurant. The reason behind all this nonsense is that they... The ducks were so valuable that they had a little silver tag attached to their ankles when they came from the farm in Challance. And at the end of the meal, you were presented with a little silver tag. And I'd read this in the original story and I thought, this is great, I'm going to get my silver tag.
That's provenance, isn't it?
Yeah. And at the end of the meal, they gave me a bloody postcard. And I said, you know, où est le tag d'argent, mate? and he said, oh, no, une carte postale these days. And I was, but I got my number. At the top,
we can see the number at the
top.
You can
see the number of my duck.
The number of the duck is the number of your duck.
So I then took the number and had it embossed on a set of dog tags along with the date that I'd done it. And I still occasionally wear them for luck if I'm doing something that needs luck. So I do have my silver tag finally from the Tour d'Argent. It was lovely. It was way too rich. Now there are restaurants in London that have started bringing back the crushed duck, and it is a marvelous bit of restaurant history. But it seems weird that I sort of end up sort of doing this kind of stuff for a living, and yet I somehow spotted it as a kid.
Yeah, it's very peculiar. I often wonder about to what extent the seeds of what we end up doing as an adult are really very well established as children. You think there might be a hint of them, but often it's actually written in your childhood.
Yes, it is. And it's a strange thing. I think I slid into photography sort of remarkably easily. Sort of academically, I'd been moving towards English, but I never had any aspirations to be a writer. I went into photography, and there's something about being in dark rooms and fiddling around with chemicals and working with your hands that makes a lot of photographers become cooks. Photographers and filmmakers, particularly of the old school, very often went on to become cooks or write cookbooks.
Yes. Bringing the ingredients together.
Yeah. So it's all become very, very, very circular, very spiral in a way I never would have imagined it to happen.
But you look at this postcard you received, you'd think it was from 1904.
Well, the restaurant's been there since that time, and they didn't change the design at all. This is a modern four colour print of what originally would have been an engraving sort of lithograph, I imagine. It's a lovely thing, sort of self aged.
Well, I'm really happy that you both managed to get your duck crushed, but also that they did give you this certificate, this proof that it happened. I think it certainly enhances the experience and the memory and adds another layer to it, I suppose.
Mm. Yes, yes.
Very good, very good. Well, another quick card from me. This is, they're not numbered on your sheet, but this is a card which is, I only discovered it in a box the other day. I hadn't really noticed it before. It's a Scenic View cocktail coaster cut on dotted line. So it's the normal postcard ratio, sort of oblong. But the idea is you can cut across about a quarter of the way down. And there's some pictures of a cocktail with sort of bits flying off it and a orangey pint glass. But it reveals then a square coaster. Well, it's a postcard with a bit cut off. And the image on that is some oast houses. And that was your Scenic View cocktail coaster. I hadn't seen them before, so I don't know if they lasted very long. This one was printed by C.G. Williams of Maidstone. Have you seen these, Annabella? I haven't seen these at all.
I haven't, no, but I'm a big fan of the sort of novelty postcard that, you know, with a flap or a fold or a bit you cut off or a bit that you shake or lift or whatever. And I haven't seen that. It strikes me as such a sort of minimal intervention to turn it into a coaster.
Like,
to just
not worth doing.
That top third off. Yeah, why would you need a perfectly square coaster rather than a rectangular coaster?
And it's not even absorbent like a coaster.
Quite,
it's just a shiny postcard.
Yeah.
I have got a number of postcards that are beer coasters. They're called beer mats. They were printed for a while, promotional ones. In fact, I think that is it Harvey's in Lewis?
Yeah.
Still do them. But unless these were really popular, but everyone used them, and that's why they're not out there anymore. That is a possibility. that in 1967, May 1967, this was. Anyway, I mean, it's the front that's interesting, really, but I'll give you the message. Well, here we are again. This is sent to Bermondsey from Sheerness in Kent. Well, here we are again. I hope the weather brightens up before the week is out. Very common message. Or rather, that the wind will drop. So it's a bit windy, and it would be. It was a lovely thought this morning that we didn't have to go to work. Cheerio for now. Love, Mavis. And I actually think that's a really nice holiday message. It was a lovely thought that we didn't have to go to work, because that is a magical moment when you're on holiday.
That's all you need, really.
Well, yeah, a change is as good as a rest. It is a break. The fact that you're in Sheerness or wherever they actually were when they wrote it rather than sent it, but it's just enough that they're, they're not going. I don't know. Who knows what Mavis did for a living? But thank God she got a break for, you know, a few days. And also she was lucky because it was Dutch week in the Medway in June 1967, because the Frank says that. I don't know what Dutch week included. There's a picture of a sort of Dutch schooner on the postmark. So maybe it was a rather dramatic thing to go and see. I don't know.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
You're listening to Podcast from the Past, the Postcard Podcast, and my guests today are Tim Haywood and Bella Pollen. Now, here's a surprise. We've received a postcard. And this postcard is the Friars of Aylesford from the Medway, not far from the last one. And it was posted in Maidstone. And the message says, "We think the mystery voice this week is Tommy Steele." Well, Mrs. Stevenson, I'm afraid that's the wrong answer. I'll carry on with the postcard stories. Now, Tim, what's the second postcard you got for us?
Oh, isn't this fantastic? This is a slightly aerial view. Well, they didn't have drones then, so it must be up a building, but I'm not quite sure which building it is, of Bournemouth Town Square, which isn't square, it's round. And I absolutely love this. It's a little bit before my time. Bobby's, the department store there, had turned to Debenhams by the time I was growing up there.
As every department store had.
Yeah. And to the right, just in the bottom corner of frame, is the building that was later to become the massively fashionable Jean Genie, where you could go and buy jeans in many sizes and be served by a callow youth that was me. I think that was my very, very first job. And then my second job was over on the left-hand side of the frame. You can see a sort of white building there with some script on the front in red, just to the left of Bobby's. And that's Forte's.
Forte's, the restaurant chain,
etc. Sir Charles came over after the war with his family. They came from a peculiar part of Italy. just around the base of Monte Cassino, the monastery that was there. And it had been pretty poor between the wars when the family started coming over and sort of emigrating over here. But after World War II, it became incredibly poor. People living in holes in the ground and eating whatever they could get their hands on. It was really, really grim. So
post-war Italy was pretty tough, wasn't it?
It was really tough. And so there was a great deal of immigration over here. And they created a great deal of the catering industry that was exciting. And I got my first restaurant job there. I was what's called a KP, a kitchen porter stroke dishwasher. I was 15 years old, I think. About 6 foot tall, but I weighed about 8.5 stone, wringing wet. I had very, very long hair that covered my bilaterally prominent ears, which were later pinned back by the National Health Service.
You are painting
by the time
a picture
I was about 23. Yeah. But I was a long, skinny streak of piss, and I worked in the basement with everybody who was there was Italian.
Really?
And they were real old school, proper agricultural Italians, and the family had brought them over from their own district. And these guys were hard as hell. I mean, they were really tough. Some of them were going up into their sort of 60s and 70s, and they'd been in restaurant work all their lives.
Right.
Some of them were quite young. But they were just tougher than anything I'd ever encountered. back then, catering was not full of fashionable young people with piercings, but many guys who'd been cashiered from the catering corps for poor personal hygiene and bullying, or Italians. And I remember the first couple of days I was there, I couldn't speak to anybody. You know, I didn't know what to do. I was nervous. I kept dropping things, smashing stuff. And then they started to get to know me, and they were incredibly lovely, and we could speak very, very little. But there were things like there was orange juice in giant cartons, and we would drink it out of the 1-pint mugs, the old beer mugs. I was drinking pints of orange juice. They had this thing called the cow, which was a cube about sort of 3/4 of a meter, 75 centimeters in dimensions. It was a fridge, and you open the front door and you put a box with a sack of milk inside it. There was a sort of nozzle that came out the bottom, which is a piece of rubber with a tap on it. And we used to use that as a milk dispenser. But it meant that I was drinking pints and pints of milk. And then on the top floor, there was a carvery. And they used to have a cart they used to push around every day with the roast beef on it. And I remember the first night I was there when I was doing washing up for one of the evening services. And there was a ringing noise, and the cart came down in the lift from the top floor. And the door opened, and the leader of the Italians handed me a stick of French bread, which is sort of what we used to call a French stick. Impossibly glamorous. Basically, it's just a long, flat, rolled roll. But he handed me I couldn't work out what was going on. And the doors opened on the lift, and they pulled out the cart with the remains, the smashed-up remains of the beef roast on it. And there was a lot of meat on it. And the knives came out, they started carving it off. And there was kind of, they were passing me bits of meat on the knife and showing me how to tear the bread off and dip it into the jelly in the bottom of the tray. And I was just, I was so brought into their group. And there was still no language. And they looked to this one guy, this older guy who was sort of in charge of them all, permission for everything they did. I remember them looking at him as if saying, "Is it okay to dip our bread in now?" And at one point, he's kind of moved one leg and let rip this gigantic fart.
Oh.
And then a smile spread across his face. And it was like, you know, that's it. Permission to eat.
Well, you've got to have a system.
I don't know. It was so romantic. It was like, you know, like Lawrence of Arabia being invited to eat by the Bedouin. I loved it.
Else's world.
I know. And I left at the end of the first summer I worked there. And honest to God, I looked like Thor. I'd eaten so much. This was, you know, back in the 80s. I mean, you know, there wasn't much. We weren't eating great stuff. I'd eaten more meat, more bread, more orange juice, more milk than any other human being, you know, within miles. And I had really, I got muscular and large.
Yes.
And it was great. The weird corollary of this story, and this is truly, truly spooky, is years later, again working for The Guardian, I was sent to Italy to do a story on a sort of semi-ritual pig killing.
Right.
In this area near Monte Cassino. And I was there, I stayed for 3 days with this family. We did the pig in and stripped it down to all its constituent parts and made it into salamis and hams and pâtés and things like that. And the crew were with me filming all the time. And I got to know this little bunch of guys that were there. There was one old guy, little tiny, thwart, little kobold of a man. And he had tiny little stumpy fingers, but on really, really strong, spatulate hands. And the last night I was there, we were all sitting there quaffing the red wine. And the translator said, "This guy has something he wants to tell you." And I said, "Oh, okay, what's that? Will you translate?" And they spoke back and forth. He says he knows you.
You're joking.
Did you work in Forte's in Bournemouth?
Wow.
And I'm halfway up the mountain in Cassino, looking up at the ruins of the monastery on top. The sun's going down behind the olive fields.
You can't escape your past, Tim. You can't escape your past.
And here's Vittorio with his little funny spuddy fingers who remembered me.
So how did he know you? He was there?
He recognised me. He'd been watching me all week as we'd been filming. And he couldn't quite put his finger on it, he said. But, you know, he said, "I knew you from somewhere. I knew you're bigger now." Yeah. Oh, shit.
It's your ears. They're different.
Yes, the ears have changed. But I don't know. I think that was the first time I went into a kitchen and I got that it was more about the camaraderie and the fire and knives.
Yes.
Than it was about the food. And I think it's funny, today, partly we're realising how very toxic that also becomes.
Yes, of course.
I mean, that degree of farting, meat-eating masculinity was wonderful to me. I was a fey little grammar school boy, you know, of questionable sexuality, you know, and I'm thrown into something that sort of stupidly macho. I kind of relished it. It was exciting. But you can see now how the same thing can go septic. Yes. Very, very, very fast. And yes, it has in many cases. And that's the part of a job I don't love and I'm not proud of. But there was something there that just I was injected along with the meat juice and the vitamin C and the milk. That just gave me that thing of, yeah, I love this. When these people are good, these are wonderful people.
Very interesting. Very interesting. So all kinds of scrapes and memories and reflections. Gosh, all from the most gentle-looking picture of some yellow buses going round a roundabout in Bournemouth. Very good. Very good. Thank you for that, Tim. Now, Annabella, what's the last card you've got for us today? I'll say no more. I know what it is, but tell us about this.
Well, you set me a terrible challenge because I think about postcards and I think about popular images and I think about snapshots in my, you know, my daily life, my professional life as part of my job all the time. But I also have thousands and thousands and thousands of postcards at home. So to set me that challenge of choosing, you know, a postcard, one postcard or two postcards, was really, really difficult. And so I decided to choose a postcard about postcards, because that seemed to be the obvious thing to do. And the postcard that I've selected is one that is produced by Bamforth and Co. from Yorkshire, who are famous postcard producer.
Of course.
And it's a dirty postcard, but it says on the front, "This should suit you. It's a dirty postcard." And there's no saucy image of a buxom woman bending over or a vicar and, you know, a busty matron. There is, in fact, just a filthy smear on the front of the postcard.
It's so literally smutty. It's smudgy, isn't it?
It is. And then when you turn it over, it's also rather dirty on the back, which I like, because this is a postcard that I think dates from the mid-60s. On this particular example, you can't read the postcard. It's not the postcode, post stamp, rather. It's not legible, but it's the stamp is, I think, from the late 60s, and I've seen other examples of this from the mid-60s. This is a rather filthy postcard. It's gone a bit yellow over time, and it may have been passed around by people with grubby mitts, and some of those grubby fingerprints might be my own, because this card, for a very long time, was on the windowsill, and as a consequence of that, the message on the back, it was inscribed, but the message has faded out by the sun, so it has a curious connection.
Has it completely gone?
I can see by tilting it to the light that it was inscribed, but I can't read what the message was. So it has a strange connection to my earlier one, even though it's of a very different subject and a completely different time, in that the sort of the message is gone. But as I recall, it said nothing particularly interesting. It said something like, here's one for your collection. So, in fact, even the message was about postcards, which is a very that's a very common thing, isn't it, to acknowledge the postcard itself on the back, or the act of postcard collecting on the back. So the message was nothing interesting, but the grubbiness of this card from the 1960s and the sort of the journey it's taken, and the messiness on the back as well as on the front, it speaks of my wider interest in postcards, but also, as I mentioned earlier, my kind of non-professional life, which is how my partner makes his living, which is, you know, clearing people's houses and, you know, taking stuff out of garages and sheds and taking some of it to the dump and some of it to car boot sales and some of it to auction houses and quite a lot of it to me, I have to say, because I always
get first dibs.
I do, yeah. So it's a dirty world, the world of house clearances. It's a rather sort of murky world.
Well, it's a slightly sad world as well, isn't it, often? I mean,
well, it is a very sad world. And my very first sort of interests, academic interests, the very first bits of publishing I did were about found photographs, because the way that people's personal photographs end up in car boot sales, I'm not alone in feeling this, is something that is a really... it seems to be an act of kind of social discontinuity. You know, these things that were once the things that people would rescue from a fire, the most precious family stories of loved ones and the, you know, the birth of children and these major sort of personal moments, when you see them selling for 10p in a pile on the floor in a, you know, in a junk shop or whatever, I started rescuing those and trying to restore the stories of the, you know, the lost people to them. My very first bit of sort of major research on this, I found a set of photo albums from, when I say found, they were bought from a car boot sale. In fact, my partner bought them with a view to selling them. And then I said, no, I want to keep them. This is a really common conversation.
Yes,
he says,
course.
Oh, look what I've bought. These will make some money. I say, no, hang on a minute. I'd like to have those. And it was a set of photo albums of then somebody who's, name I didn't know at all, just the initials on the cover of the album. And it was somebody who'd taken five albums between about, I think, 1919 and the late 1930s. And it was a sort of album of a life, and they'd ended up in a car boot sale. And I spent a long time finding out who the photographer was, who his family were. I traced him through birth, deaths and marriages registers. I traced this life story for him, which was actually, interestingly, completely different from the life story that his albums told, which seemed to be this kind of happy courtship, the birth of meeting a partner, getting married, having children, children growing up. In fact, he was a divorcee, and the first wife didn't appear. This was his kind of new life being documented.
Well, you don't take photographs of rows and storming out the door, do you?
No, indeed. And, you know, if you have cheated on your wife and abandoned your child and gone off with your secretary, you have to construct a rather different visual narrative in order to justify your behaviour. So, that sort of restoring kind of lost narratives and rescuing forgotten things is definitely a kind of emotional investment, although I realise it's very romantic and sometimes the stories are not very happy stories.
But
it's
also, it's almost a form of madness, though, because for every image you find that you think you can restore some sort of narrative and meaning to, there are literally millions that you can't make order out of all this chaos. It's not possible. So you're just taking a very, very thin sliver, which may well be valuable to do, but it's kind of around you on all sides is the kind of chaos screaming at you.
Yeah, and what I learned through doing that process and being involved in the sort of fringes of those secondhand worlds for decades now is that often people have got rid of things because they want to get rid of them. So this idea that you might restore this lost thing to somebody who needs it, you know, I found in that case of that album, I got in contact with the family, you know, the one of the children depicted as a baby in this photograph album. I located him and he's in his 80s and, you know, that family had broken up for a good reason and they didn't want to have this story returned to them. It was a story they wanted to forget. And I think many
So that
artists,
is your romantic notion being overlaid on it.
Exactly, exactly. So this idea of the found object and this idea that you can spin this kind of story around it, often, you know, in the house clearance world, they know exactly where this material has come from. It's kind of one or two steps removed from the house to the car boot sale table, but people buy it and go, oh, this amazing lost object.
Yes.
How can we possibly find who it belonged to? But actually you can find out, you know, fairly promptly.
But this is the collector's instinct, isn't it? That you're somehow saving things
for that idea of rescuing. So
yeah, I don't quite, and for slightly unspecified reasons, but you're somehow saving, making sense, restoring meaning. But I think you just, well, when your garage is full, you have to kind of...
Yeah, and the garage is full and the loft is full and we're reproducing, you know, the issues of the people who are having to get their houses cleared. Yeah. We're just accumulating their stuff in our house.
Yeah, and it's not even your stuff now. Well, it is your stuff, but it's second. It's one remove emotionally.
Well, yeah, and that's the interesting thing as well, is that I could be doing this work on my own family history, but actually I don't particularly want to. There's some kind of... I find it more interesting to research the lives of strangers and call myself a historian with a capital H.
I know what you mean. It's a strange definition, isn't it? And, you know, I'm the same. I tell you what, I have an absolute... I wake up in the night sweating at the fear that I will muddle genuine family artefacts, of which there are some, you know, I mean, by which I mean pictures and photographs and postcards, with the collection or the hoard of meaningless cards that I have, not meaningless, but that have no meaning to me or my family. The idea that you would lose your real family stuff into the well of this other people's stuff, it makes me sweat. It's a horrible thought.
That's so interesting. And I think it sort of speaks of this idea that there is a clear water between them, those other people, those mystery strangers from the past, and you now. But increasingly there isn't. So I had a similar thing, this sort of middle of the night sweat. One time I had a nightmare where I was at a car boot sale, you know, something I do every weekend. I was looking through stuff on a stall and I was saying, as many people do when they root through car boot sale stuff, oh, I used to have one of those, I used to have one of those. And then I realised with, you know, horror film type chills that every single thing on that stall was mine and I had died and this was all my stuff being cleared. And it was this terrible existential moment that I woke up from in a great panting sweat because I thought, you know, that's how close we all are to these things that are on the stalls. You know, they're not just things that other people used to own, they're parts of us. And I suppose that emotional investment maybe makes you treat other people's stuff with a bit more sensitivity, or maybe it's just, you know, a way to deal with that existential fear is to keep accumulating stuff and rescuing it and researching it. I don't know.
I don't think we'd better ask too many more questions. I'm glad you share these unfortunate collector's psychoses. It's it's something we live with and something we're working on. Very good, very good. Oh, well, that your dirty postcard took us somewhere different, which is great. Thank you both for sharing these postcards with us, with me, with each other, with the listeners. I've said it before, I never know where the cards will send us. I'm delighted you shared them with us. Another quick reminder, everyone at home, images of these cards, even the dirty postcard, is all going to be on the blog, postcardfromthepast.co.uk. And before we let Tim and Bella off the line, I've got one more postcard for you both. It's customary for us to end the show with one of these. So you can see the last card on your dope sheet that I've distributed.
Yes.
You should be able to see a street scene with a car and a bicycle and a few pedestrians. And you can probably see in the middle a white dot. Can you see that?
Yes.
Well, this is, as you probably know, this is a postcard record. It's a record.
Flexi disc.
Well, not quite
not
a flexi disc. Precisely. Yeah. Semi flexi disc. It's a Colourvox 45 RPM. And this is made in Hungary. And this particular one, the view is of a place called Zalegesheg. I don't know. Tim, you may have been to Hungary. I don't know.
No.
Oh, well. Well, you could probably get a very good goulash there. Yes.
Yes.
It's a town on the Zala River. It's west-southwest of Budapest. That's what Wikipedia tells me. Now, young Tom, back at Wardour Studios, has made a digital file of this record.
Wow.
Yes.
Oh,
so
that's superb.
If we ask him nicely, we should be able to hear what it's meant to sound like.
God, that's good.
It's not bad, is it?
The crackle's part of the charm.
We put that on afterwards. I think this might be a singer called Sibyl Yevele. She's got a good voice.
Yeah. Wasn't she just? That's lovely.
I mean, I make the same observation every time. This is not bad for a piece of cardboard.
So much data. So much data.
Yeah, yeah. This one, I think, if it was sent at all, went in an envelope.
I'd hope
but
so.
It does have room for a stamp and an address, and sometimes they are. I've had them sent by stamp, and they're still okay, the quality, amazingly.
Oh, I want because... with a voice on, recorded, like Pinky in Brighton Rock.
Ah. What did he say? You think I love you, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
And you bring us back to Brighton. Marvellous. Oh, very good. Well, as the streets of Zalaegh Gesheg continue to rotate at exactly 45 revolutions per minute, that's it for this time on Podcast from the Past. I'd very much like to thank my first-class guests for sharing the postcards from their past, Annabella Pollan and Tim Hayward. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And thank you for listening. Bye for now.
You can see more postcards with their messages posted every day on Twitter. Do follow me at @PastPostcard. And you can buy the book, Postcard from the Past, by me, Tom Jackson, at Amazon and all good booksellers. And if you're looking for podcast production, check out wardourstudios.co.uk.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.